All right. So, getting us back to our agenda, we're going to move to item six, which is our scheduled educational presentation from Verus on investing in a rising rate environment. We've been talking a lot about rates and the effect on our liquidity portfolio and what's happening. And so I know there's Scott, there's Ian. So we have Scott Whalen and Ian Toner from Verus this morning. Tim, I don't know if you wanted to kick this off or if
no, we just a reminder that this is a continuation of interest rates are not just a fixed income phenomenon. So we've got interest rate risk and impact embedded across the portfolio. And I thought this was a great opportunity for Verus to be able to frame in our minds how we should think about these linkage mechanisms, how rising rates kind of move through the portfolio. And what do the models say, and where are the known unknowns and all that sort of thing. So with that, I will turn it over to Scott.
Thanks very much, Tim. So Mitch and Bryce's presentation was really good foundational information for the topics that we're going to cover. And just as an introduction, a couple of comments. We've been in a low rate environment for so long that people might forget back in the 80s when the yield on 10-year treasuries was in double digits. I think it peaked in early 81 at around 16%, 15.8%. I actually graduated from college that year, and coincidentally, Paul Volcker was the keynote speaker at my graduation ceremony talking about inflation and the Fed's plan to break its back. He was successful in that, and inflation and rates have come down steadily over the last 40 years. And the 10-year hit a record low of half a percentage point, about 53 basis points in January 2020 during the depths of the COVID pandemic. Since then, as Mitch alluded to, massive fiscal and monetary stimulus supported demand to offset the COVID shutdowns, and supply chain disruptions have reduced supply. Inflation has increased to a level we haven't seen in more than 40 years. And there's concern about what that means for interest rates, of course. With that, I'm going to share my screen.
Yeah, I would just, while you're doing that, Scott, I was going to note that I remember the 80s. The CD rate was around 14%. And I remember trying to get a loan in 1982 or 83. And the rate I was quoted for an unsecured loan was 21.5%. The good old days. Jerry Holcomb, you had your hand up.
Yeah, very nice. I was going to say, when's the last time anyone's seen an advertisement from a savings and loan for a T-bill account?
Yeah, exactly.
It used to be on sandwich boards that people would wander up and down the street.
Oh, yeah.
10 points, 11 points, 12 points. It was only for 6 months, but that was about it. And we had a wonderful flexing or adjustable rate mortgage, which adjusted up to about 11%. It was really special.
I love the historical context. It's kind of crazy when you remember that far back and think back to how times have changed. This discussion, everybody can see my screen, I hope?
Yes, we can, Scott.
Thanks for that. This discussion is designed to accomplish three things. First, as Tim mentioned, we'd like to give you an understanding of the transmission mechanism between interest rates and the different assets you have in your portfolio. We're going to provide a range of possible scenarios of where rates could go, linking it to history, and then talking about a different range of potential outcomes and what our base case expectation is as well. All of this is intended to provide you with context to help you fulfill your role as trustee. As Tim mentioned, I'm joined by my Verus colleague, our Chief Investment Officer, Ian Toner, who will pick up momentarily to help meet those objectives. And with that, I will turn to the overview of the presentation. So first principles, I'm going to talk about interest rate mechanics. Ian is then going to jump in with some historical background and talk about the current economic backdrop and those scenarios. So thinking about the mechanics, interest rates and bond prices. So when we talk about interest rates and bond prices, there is a very clear mechanism that goes from one to the other, right? As yields rise, prices fall, and if rates fall, prices rise. So clearly, the falling prices is bad for bond investors. Rising prices good for bond investors. This all happens through the mechanism that is duration. So let me talk a little bit about duration. And while the direction of interest rates gives you the decision of whether bond rates are going to rise or fall, duration is really the lever that gives you the magnitude by which those rates rise and fall. And so, giving you a simple example, think about investing in two different bonds, maybe in December of 2020 when the yield on the 10-year was around 1%. So just to make the math simple, both bonds will give you $100 in maturity. One is will give you that $100 in 10 years. One will give you that $100 in 5 years. So now thinking about the differences in duration or maturity. So just the bond math, if you get that $100 back in 5 years, you'd be willing to pay $95 for it today. If you get it back in 10 years, you'd be willing to pay $91 for it today. Not a huge difference over that time period at 1%, but think about raising the rate to 10%, and that five-year bond is now, you'd be willing to invest $62 versus the $95 to get your $100 in 5 years. And that 10-year bond, doubling that duration, is only going to be worth $39 to you today. So you can see the higher duration, getting your money back longer, really has a big impact depending on what rate level you're at. If rates are low, it's not a big deal. But if rates move up, it makes a big difference in terms of value that you're willing to pay, which is today's price. So you can see how the higher the rate, the longer the duration, changes that price and that value. Now, interestingly, so that transition mechanism, or transmission mechanism, I should say, is very clear with bonds. You know, it's simple mathematics, especially a risk-free bond like a treasury, where that is the one thing that's impacting the bond price. But anything with a cash flow has duration. So a stock, right? You are going to get dividends from stocks, and those cash flows will be paid out over time. And so duration and rates impacts other asset classes besides bonds. So let's kind of walk through some of the asset classes in your portfolio. So you have domestic equity, and the primary valuation mechanism is discounted cash flow. The thing that you're discounting it at is a market rate. And so as those rates move up and down, just like a bond, it's going to impact the value of that equity. There's other things that impact equities, like risk tolerance and the perception of risk in markets, but there is that duration mechanism. So beyond bonds, even into your equity portfolio, you'll have changes in value based on changes in interest rates. Some other considerations that I think are interesting to point out in an equity portfolio, certain equities or different equities, different types of equities have different durations. Think about a growth stock, maybe in the tech industry, where you're expecting more of your cash flow to be bigger further out into the future, right? Some of those tech stocks have no earnings today, and you're going to get those earnings, and the earnings are going to grow rapidly out into the future. Well, that's those cash flows further out in the future gives you longer duration. As we talked about, longer duration is more impacted by interest rates, which is why you see the NASDAQ, the tech-heavy NASDAQ, bouncing around more when concerns about interest rates are picking up. Maybe utilities, a value stock, which sort of has higher dividends maybe today and more steady, less growth. So that duration would be shorter. And so you wouldn't see that that big impact on heavier cash flowing equities. International equities, same mechanism, the discounted cash flow. But foreign exchange rates comes into play there as another consideration, where different interest rates and inflation expectations across different countries will have impacts on exchange rates. So there's a little bit of a different transition mechanism there. Private equity, you know, the biggest thing there is public market comps, where they're saying, okay, well, what's the market going to be at when I go to monetize my investment and sell it into the public market? So obviously, movements up and down in the public markets will have an impact. And also, of course, discounted cash flows as those funds are paying out. And then also another consideration, the cost of leverage. It's more expensive to implement a private equity program as rates are rising and they're borrowing to do that. Private credit is an interesting one because the instrument is typically, that you're investing in, is typically a variable rate instrument. So as rates rise, the cash flows that you're getting will rise along with those rates. And so that brings the duration way down. And so it's not going to be as impacted by private credit. But there's a second order effect there. As rates rise and these companies that you're investing in have to pay those higher rates, it's gonna cause them to be, you know, less healthy. Just like a bond that is maybe a lower credit rated bond, higher rates cause financial stress on those companies, which could and likely would impact the values. And then some of those instruments come with equity kickers, which, you know, go back to the top of the chart, have volatility related to discounted cash flows and interest rates. And then real estate is obviously a discounted cash flow instrument as you're getting those rents and you're getting them out over time, but you have an ability to raise those rents, right? So there is some inflation protection embedded in there. And so you would think that any interest rate rises that are caused by inflation are not going to have as big an impact on the real estate, although those discounted cash flows and those rising rates on those, that aspect of it, will impact it through that duration lever. And then similar to private equity, the cost of leverage, the extent leverage is embedded in your real estate portfolio. And with that, I will pause, see if there are any questions before handing it off to Ian.
Let me see here. I don't see any hands up right now, Scott, on my side gallery. So I think you are free to pass the baton to Ian.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to turn it over to Ian to talk about the relationship between inflation and rates and what you might expect going forward. Ian, welcome. Thanks for joining.
Thank you, Scott. And thank you all for your time. It's a pleasure to be here virtually, although, as you can probably see from behind me, I'm sitting in a hotel room in South Carolina at the moment. So there is shrimp and grits in my future. So the goal here was to take a look backwards and say this is an environment we've not seen for some time. Is the history of the last 100 years or so, is that helpful in understanding what might happen? Because as you all were talking about earlier, there is a tendency when things change for headless chicken behavior to appear on TV and so on and so forth. People running around and going, you know, panicking. And there are times where panic is justified and there are times when panic's not justified. And history usually gives you some understanding of where the guardrails for expected market behavior are. So we went back to about 100 years and looked at all of the environments that had been, you know, materially inflationary over those periods to try and understand what was the likely behavior in terms of rates and what was the likely behavior in terms of the dependency on central bank behavior on rates. Because obviously the central bank controls the short-term rate. The market controls much more the longer-term rate, although some of these historical events, you can see the central bank intervention that has affected the longer term rates as well. But that gave us seven examples, the Great Depression, World War II, and so on and so forth. Obviously the first half of this chart, first two thirds of this chart is while the gold standard in its various forms was still in effect. Obviously Nixon pulls the US out of that about the middle of this chart. And so the pure fiat currency world is the second half of the chart. First thing to note, we have seen inflation at these levels before. Some of us have even lived through that inflation at these levels before. Second thing to say anecdotally, I remember a year or so ago when we were talking to large investment bank forecasting teams and investment manager forecasting teams. While there were people talking about high inflation, they weren't talking about 8% inflation. They were talking about 4 or 5% inflation in the main. And so, many people have been caught off guard by the perfect storm of different things that have been happening. So what does the history tell us about that? The first thing here, and Scott, if you want to move on to the next page. The first thing, we tried to break down the periods leading up to each of those inflationary environments. And this is by the nature of this type of chart. This is kind of approximate, but we tried to look at supply and demand dynamics, monetary and fiscal dynamics, and other sort of geopolitical tensions leading into and around the time of these inflation periods to see how the current environment compared. And as you can see, the thing that jumps out of this page, two main things. First thing is that every one of these inflationary periods has been pretty different than the others. In other words, there's no single cause of inflation that's been continuous across these periods. There's some themes that run through monetary policy, fiscal policy, economic behavior, and so on. But there's no single driver that's been important in every one of them in the same way. Secondly, oh boy, the most recent one, really, we've kind of drawn all of the short straws all at once, in the sense that we've had significant increase in demand as we build out inventories and so on and so forth. We've had all kinds of supply disruptions in a much more globalized economy than was the case in any of these periods. The last time the economy was this globalized was the period after the American Civil War and before the First World War, where there was real globalization happening. We haven't seen globalization of the kind we've had now between then and now. So supply disruptions, labor shortage, as people have left the labor market, the prime labor age of sort of 25 to 55 is now back to sort of full employment, but retired people, older people have stayed out of the labor market, and that's causing the labor shortage. Interestingly also, people under 25 are not back to full employment levels yet, but that's creating this labor shortage. We've had high fiscal spending, big monetary policy accommodation, all kinds of deficit stuff going on, and now the Russia-Ukraine situation creating geopolitical tensions as well. So if you compare the situation we're in now to all of these previous ones, there's more of the things that drive inflation all coming up both together and independent of each other at the same time. Many of them, in fact, interestingly, you can see that there's an end that will come to those things, but sadly, not all of them. So in context, when we look back at this history and we see what's happened historically, what we wanted to understand was, what did this inflationary environment suggest for interest rates? And the answer surprised us a little. In fact, we had a little bit of a fight in our investment committee when we came up with these. Well, fight. It was an investment committee. We grumbled at each other, but we still had kind of a, oh, this is surprising reaction to the numbers, because we thought that there would be a closer tie between some of these data points than we discovered. The thing we'd like to say is interest rates rise because of inflation. And this is kind of a market effect and so on and so forth. In fact, what became clear to us is that really the thing that drives interest rates is central bank activity. And there's a much less inflation. If central banks don't react to inflation, then the longer term interest rate hasn't historically moved. The real driver of that longer term interest rate is the Fed, is the central banks. And there is a fairly tight tie between the central bank behavior and the longer term rate behavior. On average, it's about a 1% differential. It can get to as much as a 3.5% differential, but it doesn't tend to get beyond that. So over the past 100 years, when you had these jumps of inflation and the Fed didn't raise, not quite yet, the Fed didn't hike rates, rate rises were small, And so what does that mean for the future? Now let's move on to this chart. And so what this looks at is this looks at the 10-year yield going back to 1962. And of course, rose significantly and then dropped significantly, surprisingly, from the period of that peak to the bottom. Everyone who was a bond investor was an absolute genius, because bond prices went up and up and up as yields went down and down and down. And so they turned up waving their hands in the air saying they were geniuses. But where are we now and what does it mean? Well, assume that the Fed does execute the policy that they're talking about, and that the historical relationship that I described, and that if you want to nerd out about this, that we've got all kinds of appendices in this deck, that relationship stays as average, that 1% relationship, maximum 3.5% relationship, you would see all of those rises go through. The maximum steepness of the yield curve would take the 10-year from 3-ish to 8-ish up to a bit less than 6. But that's a pretty unlikely scenario. More likely is it stays around the average, and we'll see why in a minute. And so that would take the Treasury up to somewhere mid threes, assuming those historical relationships stay intact. So let's move on. What does this environment look like? Well, we think that the Fed pushes rates up in the way that we've talked about, and the pattern we were talking about, pushing, 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 and then taking a breather and pushing, taking a breather. And at the same time, starting to drop the balance sheet. And I completely agree with one of the previous speakers saying that the dropping of the balance sheet is going to be probably a bigger component of the story than we're talking about now, because that's a material effect on monetary policy. But the Fed will push up that front end of the curve, which means probably we see a flat or maybe even inverted yield curve if the market doesn't believe in the long-term inflation story and doesn't believe that they want to break that relationship we've seen. So what does that mean? On the next page, we can see the dot plot, this rise through time, but only a rise to a certain level. Even if they get their 9 rises, we're not talking at this stage of getting rates outside the historical norm, in fact, relatively low in the historical norm. What does that mean? On the next page, what we can see is we can see the 1-year forward yield curve. The orange line here is the current yield curve as of the 11th. It's changed a little bit, but it's pretty similar now. Rates rising over the course of the next little bit, up to about a year, and then flat. And then you have, looking 1 year out, what's the market pricing? Market's pricing essentially a flat to mildly inverted yield curve. So the expected move is short-term money goes up, and then long-term bonds staying roughly where they are. What does it look like if we move to the next slide and we look further out? Instead of 1 year forward in the market, 10-year forwards in the market, we see a similar kind of behavior. In other words, the market is expecting a move in short-term rates and then the long-term price for money staying roughly the same. Inflation going away through time, even if maybe a little higher, and the market not expecting to see this, you know, very steep yield curve. So you wind back a few slides, that sort of 3.5%, that 3.5% steepness that would be is the maximum we've seen, unlikely to happen. So a flatter yield curve environment because of this expectation that the economy will cool, many of the inflationary things will drag off. And so we won't be expecting to see the yield curve moving up in parallel with 10-year and 30-year bonds shifting up very significantly. What does this potentially mean for the portfolio? This is incredibly difficult to forecast. And this slide is simply using some examples provided by MSCI Barra. There's all kinds of ways we can model the portfolio, and we're having those conversations now. But the key question is really, you know, does the Fed do too much too early or too little too late? If either of those scenarios happened, then there would be some downside for the portfolio. Assume that there's an ideal timing, this soft landing, then maybe you see continued progress in risk markets. Maybe things work out through time. The question here isn't the results of these models. but is more the dialogue that's in place on an ongoing basis between the investment team, trying to understand what the effects might be. And that conversation is continuing, as we heard earlier today. The key question is, the road bumps could come if the Fed leans in too hard, if the economy does break, then that could cause challenges to risk assets and to underlying economic growth. So conclusions on the next page. History tells us that interest rates don't typically rise just because of inflation. Interest rates rise mainly because of inflation and central banks reacting to that inflation, pushing the short term of the curve up, and the markets believing that there's going to be a long-term component pulling the long-term up. The plans that the Fed has are fairly moderate, although we have to take into account the balance sheet moves as well. The fragility of some of the underlying components of the economy, the fact that some of this inflation feels more like fever than long-term, the structural questions, suggest interest rates may not rise too much despite that high inflation, because there's real concern about breaking components of the economy. Particularly, for example, the labor market question. If you start seeing a big inflow of people, the over 55 and the under 25, back into the workforce, those participation rates and unemployment rates might change fairly rapidly. It's important to think about which part of the curve is likely to rise, and the answer is probably short-term rather than long-term. And probably we don't see that long-term money rising overly excessively. As I said, the average relationship is about a 1% differential. It can get up to about 3.5 in really extreme circumstances. But the conclusion, really, to take a step back, is this is an uncomfortable situation. As we've seen, there are effects on bond portfolios because of duration, because of these rate rises. Those will be uncomfortable, and those are just the nature of bond math. Those rate changes will affect other asset classes as well because of the nature of the discounted cash flows, as Scott alluded to. But some of the extreme scenarios, unless we see more extreme news coming down the pike, there are some fairly moderate outcomes that we can see, at least as the base case at the moment. And so a carefully planned out approach, as we've been talking about, makes a lot of sense. So with that, I will pause, draw breath, and be open to violent disagreement.
Well, I don't know about that, but let me look here. I don't see any hands up right now, Ian. Oh, no, I'm sorry, Jay, you had your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, just a quick question. I mean, given the concerns you talked about, I'm wondering what kind of recommendations you're making to other public pensions like ours. And maybe we're a little bit different, you know, not a lot of long duration, and not a lot of directly inflation sensitive assets either. But just generally, what kind of recommendations are you making to your other clients and just to set some kind of expectations going forward?
So the recommendations are usually fairly similar, in the sense that we hope that all of our clients have done similar things to what you have done. There's an ongoing conversation about what might happen, and there's plans in place. There's a well-structured portfolio that's designed to deal with the variety of environments. So as long as you've got that in place, then my boss has a phrase, plan your work and work your plan. This is the work your plan component of it. In other words, make sure that your portfolio is doing what you'd expect it to do. Identify if there's things that are behaving oddly, and if so, you might have an issue. But if not, keep going down the path that you've laid out in advance, because this type of scenario is the kind of thing that you should be planning for. We hope that all of our clients are in that position, and reassuringly, most of them are. So really, this is just doing exactly what's happening now. Model what the effects look like. Be sure that the plans you had in place are stable in this kind of environment, and then keep plugging through doing the things that you do just to keep the plan on track.
Yeah, and Jay, just to add to that a little bit, maybe to put a finer point on that, right? We help our clients, and you guys have done this to a great degree, of building a diversified portfolio that should carry you through most, if not all, market environments. We look at it in a couple of ways. One is a strategic asset allocation, right? Which is that broadly diversified portfolio to help you get through all the different market environments. And then when the extreme environments occur, taking advantage tactically in a very well-considered, thoughtful way. We're not viewing this environment as an environment where we would make tactical recommendations and count on your strategic allocation getting you through.
My interpretation, remain calm and carry on. Jerry Holcomb, you had your hand up.
And to that point about keep calm and carry on, this is entirely anecdotal, but it's of interest to me the number of people I talk to that don't appear to be as panicky as they were years and decades ago when there are downdrafts in the market. I'm kind of pleasantly surprised at the number of people that sit back and say, this is a buying opportunity. I'm going to look around, and it's not, you know, jump ship, we're going down. And I just wondered if you think that that's a more than just an anecdotal reaction, or are retail investors and even other investors becoming a little bit more sophisticated about these changes?
Ian, I'll start with that, and then you can, of course, tell me where I'm completely off base. But, you know, I view a lot of this stuff through a behavioral finance lens, and there are so many behavioral biases that we as individual investors bring to the table. And I think a lot of what's driving investor behavior now is the collective experience really going all the way back to the tech bubble bursting, right? So we had the tech bubble, we had the global financial crisis, we had the taper tantrum, and people, I think, are used to these 100-year floods coming around more often and being followed by buying opportunities due to Fed intervention and really taking advantage of that Fed put. So I think that that's what's in the collective mindset of all investors, institutional and retail, and is a large part of what's driving the sort of not panicking in the face of big market drawdowns. Now, the interesting thing about that is people always get, or very often get, burned by their behavioral biases. And we could be entering into a new regime potentially where the Fed is not going to be able to come in and save the markets because of inflationary concerns, and that liquidity that has driven those buying opportunities may actually dissipate. And Ian or Tim, happy to have you step in.
Yeah, I guess I almost get that sense that the institutional and the retail investor population looks at a downdraft as being of likely short duration. They're not even necessarily looking for a specific curative factor. It's just that you see the market will dive 300 points, 500 points, 800 points, and a couple of days later, it's back up again, or at least largely back up again. It's almost as if people have said, you know, we can go through this. We're not looking for a quick fix, and it'll come back.
That's certainly been a much bigger part of the dialogue. Part of it is professionalism. Part of it is better literature available. Part of it is better training. Part of it is the fact that the Fed put has been more clearly expressed over the last 20 years. So that helps. But yes, I think the academic literature over the last 40 or 50 years has got better and has been more clearly expressed to both institutional and personal investors. And by the way, there's still plenty of, and look at Robinhood, there's still plenty of bits of the marketplace that's all about gamification and doing silly stuff with your money. So if you want to do that, you can go do that elsewhere. But there's a much bigger industry focused on stick to your plan, keep reinvesting, keep rebalancing, than maybe there was 30 years ago, where it's churn and burn.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that, for institutional investors such as yourselves, you have and understand, you have a portfolio and understand that portfolio is designed for the long term, and you can accommodate some volatility. So there's really no need to be moving the portfolio around in response to near-term market activity or the market environment.
And now if we could just get the CDC to follow the same philosophy, you know, not a different approach every day.
Yeah, it's a lot of volatility, and there's still a lot of people selling, that's for sure. I don't know who leads that pack, but there's a lot of downdraft. Any other questions for Scott and or Ian? Tim, you had a comment or a thought.
Yeah, I just, and this may be a difficult question and maybe an unfair question, but on slide 13, where you talked about the impact there, How do you think about the handicapping of the likelihoods there, either in percentage terms or what's becoming more likely or less likely?
Yeah, so I'll jump in on that, Ian. Again, you can respond if you want. So that was really, that slide was specifically there to just, you know, kind of set the boundaries of potential outcomes. There are a ton of assumptions that go into that based on the models that we use. And I don't want to handicap because it really is just, you know, based on all the assumptions, if this specific activity happens, what is a rough heuristic, right? And so, you know, you just have kind of a range there for the trustees to ponder of if things go right or if things go wrong, and just kind of giving them a heuristic sense of what could happen. So not a very satisfying answer, but that's what I got.
Who's honest, Scott?
Brutally
sad. All right. Let me see. I don't see any other hands up. So as usual, fascinating stuff. Today's been a day of interest rates and fixed income, crazy volatility in the markets. What's it all mean? So it's a lot to get our arms around. But I think the takeaway today is remain calm and carry on. We're built for this, and we will see a sunset and a sunrise tomorrow, it sounds like. If that's a fair summation. Well, with that, well then thank you, Scott. Thank you, Ian. Thank you for joining us remotely from South Carolina. Enjoy the rest of your day on the Eastern Seaboard.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Remain calm. All right.